Let me introduce my guest Elvis Costello by quoting rock critic Greil Marcus. Quote, in 1977, Elvis Costello emerged in London as one of the unquestioned originals of modern pop music. Just 22 when he released his first album, My Aim Is True, he seemed master of every rock and roll move, on record and off. He combined the brains of Randy Newman and the implausibility of Bob Dylan, the everyman pathos of Buddy Holly, and the uniqueness of John Lennon. Everything was up for grabs in his music. Love, money, status, hope, fear, and perhaps most of all, the very notion of control. No punk in terms of craft, he rode the punk wave because he communicated a more authentic bitterness than any punk. His demands on the world were more powerful, and thus his rejection of the world, when it failed to deliver, was more convincing. Unquote. Elvis Costello is the performing name of singer, songwriter, and guitarist Declan McManus. He's here today with his guitar, but before he plays for us, let's hear something from his new album. It's his 12th studio album, his first on Warner Brothers Records. Costello's songs on this new record show off his wide range of stylistic influences, rock and roll, pop, jazz, and political ballads. One song was co-written by Paul McCartney, who has a cameo on the record, as do Roger McGuinn and Alan Toussaint. On this song, Deep Dark Truthful Mirror, Costello is backed by the New Orleans musicians, the Dirty Dozen Brass Band.
One day you're gonna have to face a deep, dark, truthful mirror. And it's gonna tell you things that I still love you too much to say. The sky was just a purple bruise. The ground was iron, and you fell all around the town until you looked the same. Same eyes, same lips, same life from your tongue trips. Deep dark, truthful mirror.
Elvis Costello, welcome to Fresh Air. It was mentioned in an article that when you first started to perform, you were performing folk music. Mm. Is that right?
Well, when I first picked up the guitar when I was about 14 or 15, you know.
What kinds of songs?
From the start, I wrote my own songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned a few chords. I learned, like, a couple of songs just off the radio. And then once I realized the trick of it, I just went back through all my favorite songs. I learned Beatles songs. I learned, like, folk songs. Not so much traditional songs. I never much cared for them, actually. But then I went and played in folk clubs, and I actually, for ages, for about 3 years, I never played anybody else's songs. I always played my own. I mean, I tried to think what they might be like now. You know, oh, you know, that girl in the class, she won't speak to me. You know. So like,
well, you, when you started to perform, your manager gave you the name of Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
Elvis from Elvis Presley, Costello from your mother's maiden name.
No, it's my great-grandmother, actually.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
You see, all these things, they get, like, changed slightly, and then it gets passed on, you know?
Well, I remember being in England in 1977 and looking at one
Don't
of the...
Don't we all?
Looking at one of the magazines and seeing that great picture of you, like the one that was on the album cover of My Aim Is True, with you in the name Elvis Costello in a kind of Buddy Holly-ish pose, and it was such a striking photo. I knew I had to go hear you, and I think that's... A lot of people felt that way, even just by the photograph, that there was something happening here that was kind of interesting. Who was responsible for that pose, and how did you feel about it?
It was just a coincidence, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the happy thing about it. If it had been amazingly contrived, I think it would have been hard to sustain. And obviously, beyond a certain point, I don't want to be pegged as the same person as I was at 22. The way anybody wouldn't want to, you know, be constantly reminded of something. But when I first started, I remember doing that photo session. I had two jackets at this point. That's all I had, two jackets. You know, I was trying them on, and we did some shots with this tweed jacket, and that, even considering I was wearing horn rims, that seemed a little bit too serious. So I put on this other jacket, it was kind of a mohair jacket, and I said, we're happening now, and I had my electric guitar, which we didn't have plugged in, so that immediately makes it kind of comical. I think all I remember is the photographer Keith Morris and my manager, both of them guzzling bottles of cider, which was our chosen drink because it was very cheap, sort of all going, go on, throw the funny legs, you know, do some of those rock and roll, kind of as a send-up of that, you know.
Yeah.
So contrary to the image of the intense, sort of furious young man that's often written about in such romantic terms by rock critics, We were having a joke at the expense of all that imagery, and people fail to see the gag, you know, obviously, because we, you know, you're frozen there for a moment, and it came to represent something else, because the music obviously wasn't humorous like that. It was aggressive, you know, so there's a curious little inside story. You know?
Was there anything liberating for you about having a persona so that did it help at all in pouring out your emotions, because there was something actorly about it as well?
No, because I mean, I'd learned through a harsh apprenticeship, which I'm sure everybody, I'm not saying it was any harder for me, you know. I toughened up my voice. I knew how to sing very loud, because I'd had to shut people up in clubs when I was playing solo. I'd played in bands, and all the sort of things are where you learn. Now, I mean, a lot of people these days might get plucked out of obscurity at 19 and turned into some sort of sensation for 15 minutes and then thrown back outside again. So I count myself as rather lucky that didn't happen, because obviously I had still a lot to learn. And even once I started making records, I still had to learn how to make records, because even that first record has a naivety about it, which obviously is very attractive to some people, but it grates on me, because I can hear all of the awkwardness of being in the studio and not really knowing how to sing and everything on mic. I knew how to sing at a club and everything, but I had to relearn all of that, all this technique and everything, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's not to put it down, but it's different for me to listen to it than for other people, you know?
Right from the start, there was something really different about the songs that you were writing and the lyrics you were writing. And I think back to one of your early songs, like Mystery Dance. There's a long history in rhythm and blues and rock and roll of people writing songs bragging about their sexual prowess. And then you come up with a song about someone who doesn't know how to do it.
Well, you know, I think there should be. I'm still doing this, fulfilling this role as I see it. You know, I'm not do it. You can't do it too consciously, because it's like being contrary, you know. But I do think there should be songs to sing for the people, you know, that don't have a voice, you know, there's plenty of songs that represent the other people. So once in a while, it's so easy to fall into the pattern. I thought, you know, it isn't like saying, well, that's really me all the time. In the same way now, you know, you might sing a song that might express one point of view, which you're moved to write about that. Now, other people might say, well, you know, what does that mean to do that? You know, say a song from the new record called Let Him Dangle is about this this famous hanging case that went on in 1952. It's a story I've known most of my life. And some people go, well, why do you write that? You know, because it's not going to change anybody's mind. Anybody that really believes in capital punishment really believes in it, and you're not going to sway them with the song. But I feel there should be songs to sing for the people who do think my way about it, that it's wrong. And it shouldn't just be down to arguments. There should be songs, there should be poems, there should be paintings, there should be whatever, you know, whatever ways we can express our feelings about it. They all go together. They all mean something in the long run. It's on a scale with these other people who, you know, a lot of the time are arguing for the sake of political gain and not really for what they believe, you know.
My guest is Elvis Costello, and you've brought a guitar with you. Would it be okay for me to ask you to sing a song?
Sure. I'll get out this guitar here. I'll sing this song I wrote in Greenland. Can I sing a song I wrote?
Sure. Yeah.
This is a first on public radio. Here we go. Song written in Greenland, 500 miles above the Arctic Circle, in a place called Uminak. I was on holiday up there, and you know, all they have up there is huskies and big blue icebergs and the few surviving large mammals in the sea, you know. And you know when they tell children that Santa Claus lives at the North Pole, you know. I started to think maybe God lived at the North Pole. When you look down the world at what we laughingly call civilization, these thoughts came to mind, and I made up this little story about this comedian who dies and goes to heaven and has to face his maker. Now, of course, he's made a career out of playing a drunk on stage. Do you remember those drunk acts they used to have?
Yep.
Only this guy plays a drunk priest. So, being as he's been making fun of God's mercenaries on earth, he's more than a little nervous.
I wish you'd known me when I was alive. I was a funny fella. The crowd would hoot and holler for more. I wore a drunk's red nose for applause. Oh yes, I was a comical priest with a joke for the flock and a hand up your fleece. Drool in the drink and the lipstick and grease paint down the cardboard front of my dirty dog collar. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And I'm going on to meet my reward. I was scared, I was scared, I was scared, I was scared. He might have never heard God's comic. So there he was on a waterbed, drinking a cola of a mystery brand, reading an airport novelette, listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem. He said before it had really begun, I prefer the one about my son. I've been wading through all of this unbelievable junk and wondering if I should have given the world to the monkeys. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? He might have never heard that God's comic. I'm gonna take a little trip down paradise's endless shores. I'm sitting here on the top of the world. I hang around in the darkest night until each beast has gone to bed. And then I say, God bless, and put out the light. While you lie in the dark, afraid to breathe, and you beg and you promise, and you bargain and you plead. Sometimes you confuse me with Santa Claus. It's the big white beard, I suppose. I'm going up to the pole where you folks die of cold. I might be gone for a while if you need me. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're all going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? You might have never heard, but God's comic.
Great song. That's Elvis Costello performing in our studio. And that song, God's Comic, is on his new album, Spike, which has just come out on Warner Brothers Records. Is your idea of like a just God, a God who knows enough to not like Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Well, you know, God's little waiting room there that he's in gets bigger and bigger in my imagination every day. You know, the detail becomes clearer. The song will probably get longer as I go on. You know, the waterbed's now blue and it's full of tropical fish. And I see God watching 5 televisions at once, you know, because he can do those things. You know, he can see everything. So he watches, like, you know, he watches the colorized version of It's a Wonderful Life, you know, and 9 1/2 weeks and CNN all at once. You know, he can do that. And he reads, like, Jackie Collins with one eye, you know, Rockstar or something like that, and a Jeffrey Archer book with the other eye. And,
but does he have good taste?
Well, he reads, with his third eye, he reads Bret Easton Ellis, so you tell me. and his head, you know, and I was never really sure when it says, God says I should have given the world to the monkeys, that maybe it should have been spelled, you know, K-E-E-S, you know, and maybe God should get his red guitar out. Take the last train of Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You know, that's God singing there. That wasn't me.
And your first album came out in 77 or 78. Now, like 12 or 13 years later, whatever it is, do you still feel alienated from the mainstream of rock music?
Not really. I think they're alienated from me. They're all wrong. It's not me. No, I never really consider it that much. I like some things. You know, I like some... Like, I like Bon Jovi. You know, I like that Bad Medicine song. I think that's a good song. And then another time I'll like something, you know, way off that most of the other people haven't heard, you know. And not that I... You know, people seem to think that songwriters have some special information, you know. I mean, I read the same papers, the same books, see the same films, watch the same television programs, eat the same food as everybody else. And I don't really consider, really, in a big way, what's going on in the mainstream. I think that's kind of a journalistic device, you know.
You once said that you thought there was just a lot of dishonesty in most pop lyrics.
Well, there still is. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things made, a lot of small things made very large, you know, and there's a lot of talk about love, you know, but there isn't a lot of it evident. You know, there's a lot of, the word love is used a lot in songs, but I don't hear a lot of it in the subject matter, and it's not in the imagery with which the songs are presented.
Do you think that there's a kind of lyric that's become bankrupt, that it's difficult to write or sing anymore?
Well, no, because whenever you just get that impression, somebody will come up and write a beautiful love song that uses all the, you know, the 18 words it takes to write a love song and really turn it on its head, you know? I mean, there's a song on the new album that my wife Cot wrote that I think is... if I had written the words, I might have been looking for, like, new words to describe those things. And sometimes you can kind of... lead yourself down a blind alley by doing that, because you get afraid to use the simple words that everybody recognizes, because they have been so overused and all the mannerisms and everything. Can I play a little bit of this song?
Oh, sure, yeah. This is Baby Plays Around?
Baby Plays Around. See, I wrote this song, I'll just play a verse of it. This is a song Chet Baker just did before he died, and I wrote it with him in mind, funnily enough, and this is about the fifth time this has happened to me now. I write songs with no way of ever knowing whether the song's going to reach these people, and suddenly they pick it up. It happened with Dusty Springfield, it happened with Johnny Cash, it happened with George Jones, it happened with Roy Orbison, and now it's happened again. So I wrote this song, so this is the example, really, of what I'm saying. This is a little verse from a song called Almost Blue. You know? Almost blue, almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here and she's almost you. Almost all the things that your eyes once promised, I see in hers too. Now your eyes are red from crying. Almost blue. See, so that song is it's fine in its own way, but it's already gets into, like, a lot of sort of goes a little round the houses a bit, you know. It's pretty enough, but then there's this other song which I think is kind of a better song. So also I might remember all the chords of this one. It's not open to discussion anymore. She's out again tonight, and I'm alone once more. She's all I have worth waiting for, but baby plays around. So it seems I've always been the last to know, to hold on to that girl
I had to let her go. I wish to God I didn't love her so. 'Cause baby plays around. I try to be strong, hold on to my pride. She doesn't even know it's wrong. How much I hurt inside, and heaven knows I've tried, but baby plays around just to play thing. It's hard to reconcile the facts I'm facing. It's not open to discussion anymore. She walks those shiny streets, I walk the worn out floor. She's all I have worth living for. But baby plays, baby plays.
And that song's on your new record.
It's on the new record, yeah. And I mean, I went out to buy a paper, and when I got back, Cod had written that and sung it into the tape recorder. See, but it has simpler language, and it's just, the job was just to find out, you know, how to say it very plainly. And I mean, on the record, it's not a lot different to the way I played it then. There's a couple more instruments playing, but very softly. And, you learn a little as you go on from listening to other things. And obviously, you start off with a model or something that might be in your head. In the case of that Almost Blue song, it was, you know, a little bit after a song called The Thrill Is Gone, and a little bit after the song Gloomy Sunday, you know, the same. I wanted to create the same sort of mood. Now, that's a big task, so maybe I hadn't really learnt quite enough, and although I'm proud of the song and I'm delighted that Chet Baker did a version on it, I still think, as a singer and everything, I had to learn a little bit more. And, you know, really, sometimes somebody coming straight into it and just sort of like seeing exactly what they want to say, without all this stuff, you know, that you have to go through, maybe can write a song like that. And my job was just to put the chords behind the melody, because Cot doesn't play the guitar. She just sings the tune straight out of her head, which is like a magic trick, you know, to me.
Where does your persona exist now? You still record under the name of Elvis Costello, although I think you legally changed your name back to Declan McManus. Is that just a name you use for recording now?
Well, it's a brand name, you know. It's like Ferrari or something, you know. People remember it, and it would be foolish, you know, to dispense with it completely. And from time to time, I use different names as a theatrical device. I mean, people, if actors won't put down their role, they're thought to be rather neurotic, you know. Whereas in music, it seems like if you change your name, it must, it's burnt onto your psyche or something. And amateur psychoanalysis, analysis is a favorite pastime of rock critics, and they seem to read far too much. I mean, they transfer their neurosis onto you, which I think is rather unfortunate for them, really. You know, it doesn't really bother me. I leave it all behind, you know. I've done shows. I did the show with a spinning songbook where I put all of the song titles on this big 20-foot game show wheel and had people come out of the audience and spin it in order to select the material for the show that night. And, I mean, I needed an MC personality for that. It wasn't appropriate to do it as me. So I invented this Napoleon Dynamite character who could say outrageous things to the girls that came up to spin the wheel, and you know, I'd cajole them into the go-go cage. And we had perfectly ordinary people who came for a night out getting into a cage and go-go dancing. Now, I couldn't persuade them to do that, but Napoleon could, you know. On another occasion, I've released records under the names The Coward Brothers and The Imposter. It's a theatrical device, you know, and that's just it. It's the name. Nothing dark about it, you know.
Your first records were made in the context of, in the climate of punk rock, and whether you felt a part of that or not, that was one of the very radical things happening at the time. How do you think that starting to record at that time affected you as a performer and affected the way your work was perceived?
I have no idea about the perception side of it, because that's for other people to say, but it meant that I adopted a musical language quite consciously that was very, very narrow. and it really helped edit out a lot of maybe unnecessary things. It also edited out some things which I appreciated, but I thought there would be another time to present. Like, I wrote a song in about 1975 called Stranger in the House, which later was I recorded with George Jones. Now, I recorded a version of that at the sessions for my first record, but I didn't think it was right to include it on the album because, you know, country music was like, you know, the most, was like the opposite of punk rock in people's perception. And while I wasn't I bothered about whether anybody thought I was a punk or not, I didn't want to confuse people by doing too many different things, like as if it was a card trick. Oh, here I am, I'm very versatile. I wanted to have a very definite, you know, go at this first record, and then hence the name of the album, My Image True, and the arrangements are very simple. And, you know, I suppose it might sound a little arrogant, but I had the notion that I might get to make a second record, but I didn't really know. So the best way to ensure that I got a second record was to make sure the first one was very definite, you know.
One last question. A lot of your early records were about anger and frustration, and then your songwriting really opened up to encompass all kinds of different subjects and different emotions. I was wondering if that reflected an emotional change in you, just a broadening of your music, or, you know, if you had lost any of that anger, if that was just one part of your music that we were seeing then.
Well, like I said, I made a conscious decision that I was going to leave certain things out. There are many more feelings than even, you know, 15 albums worth of songs can express. You know, we're human beings. If we have to be pegged to one, you know, when people kind of go, I was in France recently, you know, and they interviewed me, and they had this very kind of limited view of from 1977 of who I was and what I was about, and they said, "So how does it feel to be Mr. 8? And I said, "What?" I said, "Is it true that you ate French people?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry to make a joke with you, but I spat them out and did it my way."
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.